Right. Thanks a lot. Yeah, first of all, I apologize for change of title. I just failed to change it to the one I announced, but the content is the same. Next of all, I'd like to apologize that I turn up only now, or I turned up yesterday night. I'd actually been invited to the Schladming Winter School in Austria, which happens to be on non-equilibrium physics and also happened to be to happen precisely during the same week of this. So I am actually doing what in Germany you were typically calling to dance on two weddings at the same time, and that necessarily actually means that it's not a good idea. But well, the other thing is they had pretty low level of snow there and already sort of considered renaming their winter school in its spring school. But I showed them this photograph and said it could always be worse. So here we are. Right, so let me straight away start by saying what I'd like to do. I'd like to give you a brief introduction into the field of ultra-cold gases. One could, of course, speak about for hours, but it's just meant to give a bit an idea of why this could be interesting to study non-equilibrium phenomena in many-body quantum physics. Then next of all, I'd like to speak a little bit about real field theory, so field theoretic approach to non-equilibrium physics, something new which we have just written about last autumn. I'll make it not too long, so technical details will be essentially skipped. But finally, I'd like to apply this. Actually, I'd like to apply the 2pi next leading order 1/n approach, which we happen to recover from this approach, to the equilibration problem of a 1D Bose gas. And this is a project I've been working on for quite some time in intensity with Jürgen Berges and others. Right, let's start. So, ultra-cold gases. I don't want to say too much about the experimental side, just give you an idea why I find this is really an exciting thing. So, just imagine, or realize actually, that they have atoms at nano-kelvins, and these atoms are trapped only a few millimeters away from a glass cell, through which you can actually watch these atoms being in there, and they actually watch them in the experiment using quite normal video cameras. So being able to watch them means they are not sort of enclosed in some other apparatus. That means the glass cell is at room temperature, 5 millimeters away, 11 orders of magnitude in temperature away. So just imagine or realize that these temperatures are even 2 orders of magnitude more away, further away from us than a supernova is. And also that on these temperature scales, the scale between sort of the surface of a sun, the surface of a cat, and the surface of Pluto is only a small fluctuation. And then finally, in order to make this possible, realize that these are the best vacua which have been produced on the Earth. And they are on the order of 10 to the minus 12 torr, or which corresponds in these unitaries to these numbers. And look it up, that's about the atmospheric pressure on the surface of the moon. Right, so speaking about ultra-cold gases, I need to speak about Bose-Einstein condensates, or Bose-Einstein condensation illustrated here. So what is it? Well, the only thing you have to consider at these low temperatures are essentially two numbers. One is the density of the atoms, or differently said, the inverse cubic root of that, so the mean distance between the atoms, compared to the thermal de Broglie wavelength. And as you know, when you go down with temperature, you increase the thermal de Broglie wavelength, which goes with the temperature to the minus 1/2. And at a certain stage, sort of the quantum nature of these extended wave packets becomes important, the wave packets start to overlap, and once they overlap, you cross the critical temperature into Bose-Einstein condensation. And eventually, if you go sort of approach T equals zero, you have a kind of single matter wave for these atoms. People always call it the giant matter wave, the macroscopic matter wave, which allows you to really observe quantum mechanical nature of this phenomenon simply with the camera, sort of macroscopically. So here's a picture. What they usually do is to expand their condensate, so they open the trap, and then after a while you get sort of a Fourier transform of this wave function, which is shown here. And people have realized once they saw these pictures that they easily see their Bose-Einstein condensate because a peak grows out of the thermal cloud, which is sort of the background down here. And this peak shows, again, the shape of the anisotropic, typically anisotropic trap, whereas the thermal cloud is perfectly spherically symmetric because the momentum distribution had been symmetric. Right, so this is the signature. I should say one other thing. To a very good approximation, you are sort of in this state where you have simply a macroscopic single wave function. Field theoretically, that means that people have been able from the start and for a long time to explain their physics, their experiments by mean field theory, because this is essentially what you need. You have a coherent state of atoms, you need a mean field, you need an equation for that, for statics as well as for dynamics. I'll say a little bit more to these in a minute. And there you are. So you have mean field theory at hand to study your dynamics and statical properties of the condensate. Now, I'd not like to go too much into details of what you can do there, but simply say that nowadays people are already a bit further. So experimenters can now do things in order to really proceed into the quantum dynamical and quantum statistical nature beyond mean field theory and beyond semi-classical physics in these experiments. Let me just stress that people can now do all sorts of things which make the field very interesting for non-equilibrium dynamics, so far from equilibrium dynamics. But they can observe the evolution in real time, and here's a picture of condensate sort of oscillating forth and back in a double rail trap, just taken with a normal camera. So they can really also measure it in situ here. These are kind of Josephson oscillations. They can model freely their initial state, so they can really study initial value problems. They can change their boundary conditions in time. And that's one possibility how to induce far from equilibrium dynamics in such a system. They can do that on very short time scale. And then they can measure very precisely mean densities, phases, fluctuations. They can measure more and more nowadays in order to also gain access or make you gain access to quantities beyond which allow you to probe the system beyond mean field theory. And most importantly, I think nowadays, what they can do very precisely is to measure particle numbers to a high, to a very low number differences. So they can distinguish a few hundred atoms and less. And that they do by sort of improving their optics resolution. This way, for example, in the labs of Markus Oberthaler in Heidelberg, they are now able to measure what is called squeezing, so they measure reduced number fluctuations in the systems between such sites of this two or more well trap. And in this way, they gain access to higher order correlation functions and to show that they're really in a quantum statistical regime of their system. Again, I can't go too much further into detail. Let me just say, I mean, these are pictures of these oscillations versus time. So you see that you can then measure fluctuations around the mean value, and you can measure frequencies and so on. This is a picture of how the density distribution of such a, the atoms looks like in equilibrium. I should stress also that All these possibilities have come about mainly because of laser technology. Not only the producing of condensate itself, but also what I say here, to model freely initial states and external boundary conditions. People can do very elaborate, sophisticated trap configurations nowadays. Most importantly, I think, are traps and lattices formed out of standing laser waves. So what is shown here is sort of a computer animation of what happens when you direct laser light from different spatial directions in a way that you get some standing wave lattices. So in this case, it's a two-dimensional lattice in this direction and a one-dimensional trap more or less along the third direction, whereas here you have a three-dimensional lattice. And so these atoms can be trapped in these cavities, now even independent of the internal state, so one can really study loads of different phenomena, which is very interesting nowadays also for the connection to solid-state physics, because you can model freely a solid-state system by modeling sort of the trapping the lattice potential, and then study in a much cleaner way and also on different time scales what is happening in there statically but also dynamically. One example is the so-called mod insulator transition. If you have a two- or three-dimensional lattice, or even one-dimensional lattice, you have different regions depending on how high you make the wells, how deep you make the wells, or how you make the barriers between the wells. If you let the atoms still tunnel quite frequently, then you get a kind of situation where the atoms are still delocalized. So if you go down to the very low temperatures of a degenerate gas, then they are still delocalized over the whole system. So this is only sort of a pictorial representation. It simply means that the atoms are delocalized and you have still a coherent gas, like in the Bose-Einstein condensation region. When you now ramp up your trap, then you eventually get into what is called a mod insulator state, where all the atoms are localized at the different sites, and where sort of the number fluctuations between the sites go to zero, whereas the phase fluctuations, now the relative phase fluctuations, become big, such that in experiment, when you expand these gases, you don't see anymore the interference fringes, which you see still as long as the coherences are there. So that has been done in the group of Emanuel Bloch in Munich already some years ago, and is now studied in much detail in one subfield of ultra-cold gases. And you can now go ahead and on short timescales change the trap and then observe the evolution and try to understand theoretically what is happening in these strongly interacting regimes. I should stress this regime where you have the quantum phase transition from the superfluid to the mod insulator state, that is the regime where you have essentially strong interactions in the system. So the interaction parameter is something like the on-site interaction between the atoms divided by the hopping rate. So if you have tunneling, if you have low tunneling, then essentially you have strong interaction. Now here's an example of an experiment at NIST, National Institute in Washington, so at Gaithersburg, where they studied this transition with a dynamics experiment. So they started with a one-dimensional lattice superimposed by such a sort of harmonic oscillator potential, and put a Bose-Einstein condensate at the edge of the potential, letting it now oscillate here forth and back. If you didn't have the lattice, then this would simply go on forever, and there would be sort of no damping. Now, with the lattice, you have damping through the interactions with the thermal atoms. And now they studied sort of the dependence on the depth of the lattice and found a non-trivial behavior at some stage where the damping rate, which is here shown on a logarithmic scale, suddenly jumped over several orders of magnitude. This is an example where in the strongly interacting region you don't yet understand at all what is actually going on, in which one should try to understand using theoretical methods which are capable to describe strongly interacting dynamics. Other examples are Feshbach resonance physics. I won't say a lot here about this. Simply, what I'd like you to take away is that on one side you can induce strong interactions, so far from equilibrium dynamics, by changing the external conditions. On the other side, you can also quickly change the interaction strengths between the atoms, and in this way induce non-equilibrium dynamics. And Feshbach resonances allow you to do this. You can, for example, create some explosions of condensates by suddenly switching the interaction strengths. You can study these Bose-Einstein, so BEC-BCS transitions, which are a big field now in ultra-cold Fermi gases. And let me simply flash it here, because this is a big field as well, and I'd like to come to something else, namely one-dimensional long-time dynamics. There are now experiments studying this long-time dynamics of an ultra-cold gas in one dimension, so one spatial dimension. Here's this experiment. They put condensates in a one-dimensional harmonic trap and now let them oscillate in opposite directions to each other in this trap and have something like a quantum Newton's cradle. That's how they term it. And here's a picture of how these atomic clouds go forth and back in the trap. And now they claim that they see that this essentially doesn't attenuate at all. So there's essentially no damping in the system, although there's scattering over time. And now there's a big discussion on what is actually the long-time dynamics in the one-dimensional gas, where you should have an infinite number of conserved quantities. So you actually expect that it's not, or at least it's not clear at all, that you have something like equilibration, and it's not clear whether how that equilibration looks like. There are arguments that you should eventually have some equilibration using a generalized Gibbs ensemble, but this is not a thermal equilibrium. Now the question is, what is actually happening? Yeah, the problem is, I mean, they have to argue all sorts of things, how long so how it goes on forever. I mean, they have a short time dynamics essentially, but they claim that they can sort of extrapolate. I mean, this is experimental issues. We could discuss that again. Let me come to these questions, sort of what could the intermediate dynamics in such a one-dimensional system be? And so it comes to the question sort of how to describe this in theory. There are now loads of different approaches to non-equilibrium dynamics beyond mean field theories. You can do, as we heard here as well, kinetic approaches. Well, this is sort of... there are kinetic approaches, then there are semi-classical simulations. Now, there's the possibility to study these using exactly solvable models in one dimension, like the Liebig-Linniger solution to the one-dimensional Bose gas. Then, since recently there are methods coming from quantum information theory called time-dependent density matrix renormalization group, or matrix product states, projected entangled pair states, and the like. This is a very interesting field. One should try to get benchmark tests from also for non-equilibrium quantum field dynamics. I'd like eventually talk about. So let's come to this functional quantum field theory. Now, first of all, I'd like to introduce briefly again the observables. So for the Bose gas, one has a mean field, a field expectation value for the condensate part, and for the non-condensed atoms, you have sort of the two-point function, which describes you the fluctuation around the Bose gas. You all know this very well. I can make it quick. You then generalize this to the two-point function, which is a function in XY space, where X and Y include space and time. And in a non-relativistic physics, you have to distinguish these two, where you have either psi dagger psi or psi psi. Oops. Then, so these are the observables we will be interested in. I'll write them now in a matrix form, including all these different components. I'll also extend this to the time-ordered propagator of it. So it's a two-time correlation function, the connected propagator. As you all know, in field theory, one does now time evolution using the Schwinger-Keldysh closed-time path. So from the quantum mechanical expression to the field theoretic expression, you need to introduce these forward and backward time evolution operators, and they now turn up into the the evolution of the Green's function, and in field theory then in the path integral by doubling the path integral through the Schwinger-Keldysh path integral. So let me now still briefly at the end introduce this functional RG approach, which I can't go into much detail, but let me just describe the idea. So what we'll start with is generating functional for correlation functions, connected correlation functions, which is now extended. So here's the basic generating functional, and it's now extended by this cutoff function. And it includes a two-time cutoff function in the two-time plane in a way that sort of for low times, you have the full path integral, whereas for large times, everything is suppressed. I mean, if you take here the functional derivatives on Z, then you get here two fields. So what R is simply chosen zero inside this square, and outside it's chosen to be infinity. You can now model this cutoff in different ways. What we did is simply take a hard cutoff, so it goes really from zero to infinity. And now what you do is you change, so this time is given by your cutoff time tau. Now what you do is you derive an evolution equation in terms of tau for essentially, or in the end, eventually, for the effective action of the theory. And this evolution equation is well known in quantum field theory by now. It's the functional renormalization group equation initially introduced by Christoph Wetterich in the 90s. That's how it looks like for those of you who know it. So you have a flow equation in this parameter tau, and of the full effective action, which is defined here, so the Legendre transform of W, which is the logarithm of Z, you know that. And on the right-hand side, what is involved here is the inverse of the proper two-point function, the cutoff inverse, and the time derivative of this cutoff function. So let me not go into details how you derive this, and simply stress the fact that you now have the possibility to derive equations of motion, first of all, flow equations for the endpoint functions from this exact flow equation for the full effective action. So here's it again in terms of diagrams. So this is the full flow equation with the inserted R. This is the propagator evaluated at time tau. And without now going through all the calculation, by simply taking functional derivatives, you derive flow equations which are still exact for the endpoint functions. Here we take it up to the four-point function. And on the right-hand side, what is involved are, again, the cutoff function, then the propagators in blue, the three-point vertices, and the four-point vertices in red and green. And here's also a six-point vertex. So it's not a closed system. But what you can do is you can truncate now the system and what we did is simply throw away here the six-point term. Once you've done that, now you can do two different things. You can either start from a solution and then evolve the dynamic solution in the tau time, including more and more quantum fluctuations. On the other hand, what you can also do, you can first of all integrate over tau, and that's what we did because the cutoff function is so simple, and derive again a set of dynamic equations for your endpoint functions. So let me just flash how these equations of motion look like once you've integrated over t. So you get an equation of you get first of all an integrated equation for the two-point propagator, another one for the four-point propagator, and now this you can reformulate in a kind of Schrödinger-Dyson equation, which then needs the information here from the equation for the four-point function. We can discuss in more detail what this is technically like. I shouldn't do that here. The only thing I'd like to say in the end is that this gives us here's the Schrödinger-Dyson equation. This gives us a set of equations which we can iteratively solve, and in this way get the dynamics for the observables of interest. So it is now a closed system which you can solve in a straightforward way on the computer. What we finally did, and which connects us to the, as I said initially, to the 2PI effective action and the next leading order 1 over n approximation, is do another approximation to the four-point vertex, which only takes the S-channel into account. So only this part of the Bayer diagram, I should have said before, because you don't understand this at all. Here you need to put in an initial condition when you integrate up, and this initial condition we simply chose to be the classical vertex, so the Bayer vertex, which is shown here diagrammatically. Now, from this we take here only the S-channel contribution, also the S-channel to the one-loop diagram, on the right-hand side. If we only take these into account, here they are again, the other ones shown away, then we could show, I lost the slide, oh, this is bad. What we could show is that that this is exactly the same relation, or this gives you exactly the same as the next leading order 1 over n resummation to the 2pi effective, which turns up in the 2pi effective action. So there you have resummed vertex, which is essentially a two-point function. If you have here the S-channel approximation, the times on the right and on the left side here are the same on both of these legs. That's the same as you have in the 1 over n resummation in the 2pi effective action, now to next to leading order. So here's a four-point vertex, which is essentially a two-point function, and the resummation, it already looks the same, except for the fact that in the 1 over n resummation, you have only one full vertex here on the right, and you have a bare vertex. But through these dependencies on these cutoff parameters, this is eventually the same. Right, so let me just summarize. The dynamic equations derived from the functional RG equation can be solved iteratively in time. They provide a resum four vertex beyond the 2pi next leading order 1 over n. Now it needs to be shown, of course, that numerically you can do that. I mean, you can in principle do that, but you have to do it. I mean, this is still a hard problem. So there are reasons why one would like to do now you have a real four-point vertex, so you have four time dependencies. And it allows a non-perturbative truncations, neglecting higher n vertices, and it provides a handle to study the quality of the truncation. Now, I apologize, I miscalculated a bit my time, or actually I didn't want to do it too quickly in the beginning, so I need to, I think, cut off now this equilibration of the 1D Bose gas. Let me simply state eventually that we can use then the 1 over n approximation to study the equilibration of a 1D Bose gas. And one important thing at the end, what we find is for a weakly interacting gas, we find thermalization. So we find a final state where you have essentially a Bose-Einstein distribution starting from a non-equilibrium state. We run into a Bose-Einstein distribution. You know that Jürgen has studied that in much detail also for relativistic systems and finds this. Now, the question is, of course, for such a system, is this the final answer, or shouldn't we have a different evolution on very long times, which then also takes into account higher conserved quantities? For weakly interacting gases, I guess that it's a good approximation on intermediate timescales. For strongly interacting gases, it had already shown that you can't get a temperature. You need to keep track of also other conserved quantities, and then get into a sort of non-Gibbs ensemble. And with this, I'd really like to stop here by thanking my work group in Heidelberg and my collaborators, essentially Jürgen Berges, whom I owe credits for loads of work in context with this. Thank you very much. And of course, Michael Schmidt, who is also in the audience.
Question over there.
Yes, well, there are two questions. You mentioned that you get an initial condition from the classical action, but you should also put there information about the initial state. Yes. So the first question is, where is it? Yes. The second question is, how you compare the infinite tau limit with just the usual calculation of the 2pi effective action?
Okay. Sorry, I mean, you couldn't understand it from this short, I know. I mean, it was really too much. But, well, first of all, the initial condition, I mean, we integrated up the flow equation, and now I had to put here some initial condition. Now, what we simply chose is the free inverse classical propagator for gamma T naught. And now we end up, when you now multiply here with gamma 2 to the minus 1, then you end up exactly at this equation, which is here from this one, G naught to the minus 1 times G, which is now the blue dot, equals 1 minus, and then this loop term. And this is exactly a Schwinger-Dyson equation. Yeah? And now you can go ahead and put in your initial conditions for the evolution into the initial values for G again. And this is where then the initial conditions go in for the gas. I said initially one can do also something different. And let me just go to, oh no, we have it down here. To this picture. You can, I mean, here we chose this cutoff. We could also go ahead and say we take a cutoff parallel to the diagonal, so two cutoffs actually. Let's say, yeah, set them sort of here, and so make them touch each other, and start with the solution of the classical equations of motion, and then move out the cutoff in these directions, and essentially integrate in by solving the flow equations more and more quantum fluctuations. So this would be an alternative way, for example. One could also use this. I mean, in practical Cardanov-Bahm solutions, what one usually does is one has this effectively a stripe within which one solves the equation and takes into account memory effects. Now one can use this to get an improvement and to sort of shift out here the cutoff. Now the second question, you have to...
How do you compare the
2pi. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what I did here, and it's a bit of a lengthy calculation. Once you are here, then you have these dependencies on the cutoff parameter in here. So what that essentially means is that the integrals in this loop diagrams, they go up to not to infinity, but to sort of the cutoff, or to some parameter which is on which here the four-point function depends. So if you now iterate this equation in a certain order, then what you get is that these integrals, they are sort of nested integrals. And now what you can do, eventually, you can combine all these integrals by using the fact that a theta function sort of coming from minus infinity to some value and another one. So theta and 1 minus theta add up to 1. And if you do it sort of in a neat way, then you find eventually that you prove in every order of perturbation theory that this equation is the same as the one in the 1 over n resummation.
I can see plenty more hands going up, but I think in view of the time, I think I might have to be a bit brutal and cut off questioning, and let's move on to the next speaker. So let's thank Thomas again.